In 1966, the British musical invasion was in full rock and roll mode. The Beatles were on the charts with Day Tripper, Eleanor Rigby, Nowhere Man, Paperback Writer, and Yellow Submarine, and so were Herman's Hermits, the Hollies, Peter and Gordon, the Rolling Stones, and the Kinks, along with a trifecta of hits from Petula Clark. However, in 1966, there was a song that most kids near a radio were singing along with. It was called Hanky Panky. It was the first number one record for Tommy James and the Shondells. Good afternoon, everyone. Dave Lee here for the next hour with On the Record Conversation with rock and roller Tommy James. Rashini will join you as always this Sunday afternoon, and Susie will be here with news as you would expect. But today, they've been gracious enough to bring back a little rock and roll history on this day of the Grammy Awards. I mentioned that Hanky Panky was an enormous hit song, and later in the conversation, we will talk about the intriguing story behind that. Also, a request from one of the Beatles to have Tommy James record some music, and even how the Shondells got their name. But prior to that, let's begin with a Minnesota connection. The man who sang I Think We're Alone Now, Crimson and Clover, Moni Moni, Crystal Blue Persuasion, and wrote many of those songs and many other hits, told us about an unusual connection. His young anti-establishment rock and roll group and a United States presidential candidate from Minnesota. That's right, Hubert Humphrey.
In 1968, of course, everything was politics, and, you know, the country was falling apart, and very similar to what it's doing now, actually. the war was a big issue, of course, and everything, and the assassinations that year and everything. So 1968 was really a horrible year when you really look at it. And we were asked to play a rally for the Democratic presidential candidates in Manhattan and South Manhattan, and you know, we had never done anything like that before, and Eugene McCarthy was there, and Robert Kennedy was there, and I don't know if you remember, the mayor of New York actually ran for a short time, John Lindsay, Hubert Humphrey was not there. And so we did this, rally, and, it was fine. We got put on a list of some kind, and we were asked, at a later date if we could play come out to California and play the Democratic primary out there. They were collecting rock bands. This was the first time in history rock bands and politicians had ever gotten together. So we had to turn it down because we were playing a gig in Dallas, Texas, of all places, called World Teen Fair. So we couldn't go. And as it turns out, that was the night of that show. If we had gone, it was the night Robert Kennedy was assassinated, and we would have been playing there. And I had always, and of course, here we are in, of all places, Dallas, Texas, playing this show. And we didn't know about Robert Kennedy being assassinated. This was the day before, and I had actually gone to Daley Plaza and looked around, and I was just amazed by how tiny an area it was, and all that. And so I went home feeling really creepy, and I turned on the TV as soon as I get home, and I hear about the Kennedy assassination. So I was really devastated, and I just kind of went into a funk for about 3 weeks. I just, almost a month, I just didn't want to talk to anybody, and I was really really devastated by the whole thing. Took it very personal. And all of a sudden, we get a call. Roulette gets a call from Hubert Humphrey's office. And we were, asked if we would consider coming out on the road after the convention, because they were sure he was going to be the nominee. Would we come out after the convention and meet with him in Virginia and, you know, play and see how it goes? And so we were honored, and we said, yeah, sure, of course. So that kind of pulled me out of my funk, and I sort of got into this. I had always liked Hubert Humphrey. I didn't know him, of course, but I had always admired Hubert Humphrey. And and so did my parents. And So we, it was the night of the convention where all the kids got beat up, and I'm sitting with two of my guys. We were writing that night, and we turned on the convention, and all the kids are getting beat up in Chicago, and it was just a mess. And so we're going, oh my God, what have we got ourselves into? Is every rally going to be like this? You know, is this what it's going to be? So anyway, we were really concerned, and we met him the following week. I think it was Wheeling, West Virginia. And we did that day, the entire day. There were like five stops on a little presidential plane. I think it was a DC-3 with the oil trickling down the window. They were called puddle jumpers. And we did five rallies with him. And he just was great. You know, we'd play 20 minutes, and then he'd come on and give a speech, usually in an airplane hangar. We'd just do it at the airports. And so we kind of got into this, and he asked if we would continue with him. And we did. And finally, he asked us if we would do the whole campaign with him. And we said we'd love to. And we became really good friends. And he just took us under his wing and was just very kind to us. It was really a first for all of us. And we would, you know, the typical thing was we would sit on stage with Mrs. Humphrey after we'd play and sit down, and he'd give us his speech, and then we'd go on to the next place. So we did this sort of all over the country. And before we were done, he asked me if I would consider being president's advisor on youth affairs.
Wow.
And I was a sort of a sub-cabinet position. I don't know what you'd call it, but it wasn't, you know, it was an honorary position, but it was something for a 21-year-old, as I was then. It was really incredible. And I think we said something back to him, you know, something smart, Alky, like, believe me, Mr. Humphrey, the youth are definitely having affairs, and we're just the boys to look into. He thought that was funny. Anyway, you know, he'd back up or stuff like that. And you know, it was really an honor. They gave us our own Learjet to take around the country whenever we could fly out of New York. And so we kind of spent the rest of the year with him for about 90 days, and we were with him the night he at the Leamington Hotel in Minneapolis when of the election, when of course he lost, and he just lost by the tiniest little amount, and he wouldn't do a recount. You know, there was a big scandal that Daley in Chicago had swung the election for Nixon because he was angry at the Democrats because of the way they made him look at the convention and stuff like that, and he refused to do a recount because he says the country's been through enough and Mr. Nixon's our president, let's just go with it. And I thought that was really big of him, but that's the kind of person he was. He was a great person, just a great human being. I mean, over and above being a politician, he just really was what you saw was what you got. And we loved him. And he ended up doing the liner notes for our Crimson and Clover album. He did commercials for us, stuff. It was incredible. And for years after, we corresponded back and forth, and you know, he went back to teaching some, he would send my wife and I postcards every now and then. He'd send us Christmas cards every year, and I became rather friendly with Skip, his son, who ended up being, I believe it was Attorney General of Minnesota and mm-hmm. ran for governor. And this last year, there was a 100-year celebration of his birthday. He would have been 100 years old. And we were invited out to Minneapolis to attend, and Walter Mondale was there, and all the people from the campaign. many of us were still around, and we all told our stories about the campaign and everything. So I love the guy, and every time I fly into Minneapolis, I think of him.
You know, one of the great stories, and that I'll just pass along to you because I know you'd find it interesting, when he was asked to be vice president by LBJ, he was on the air on this radio station in the morning, and they couldn't reach him because he was on our morning show goofing around with our morning team, the guys that were here before me. But anyway, eventually they got a note to him that said the president's on the other line. So he found out he was going to be the VP while he was on the air. It's a cool story, but that's a great story, Tommy. Had he won, would you have taken that position that he was offering you?
Probably.
Wow.
I mean, life would have been very different. Just a few votes left or right. We could have done a lot worse than Hubert Humphrey for president, I'll tell you that.
That was in the 1960s. But he's as relevant now in 2014, and we'll tell you why up next as On the Record with Tommy James continues on WCCO. Dave Lee here this afternoon in CCO Land. Tommy James is with us on the record today. His music began in the mid-60s and has been covered for other generations by people like Tiffany and Billy Idol. Now his story is relevant again in 2014. You could be seeing him in the movies. Tommy James is excited about the upcoming year.
Well, I'll tell you, it's going to be quite a year. First of all, you know, we released our book, Me, the Mob, and the Music, a couple of years ago.
Yeah, what a book that is.
Thank you. And, you know, we've just had tremendous response to it. It's in its eighth printing now. And it's going to be a film produced by Barbara DeFina, who produced Goodfellas and Casino and did Hugo 2 years ago with Martin Scorsese.
Wow.
Just a string of great movies. And she's going to produce this, and we're at the screenplay stage now. Appears that Universal is going to be distributing. And I've never done anything like this before, so I'm very flattered and honored that she thinks our story is worth doing.
Well, you were on Roulette Records. That's a whole interesting story, which I know the book centers on as well. Were you ever, when you first thought about writing this book, did you hesitate saying that?
Oh, yes. You know, we were, when Martin Fitzpatrick, my co-author, and I started this book, it was about 8 years ago now, and, you know, we were going to call it Crimson and Clover, and we were going to write a nice music book about being in the studio and writing songs and stuff. And it would have been interesting, but we got about a third of the way into it. We looked at each other and said, you know, if we don't tell the Roulette story, the whole story, I said, we're cheating ourselves and everybody else. This is the story. And I was very concerned about finishing the book at that point because some of these guys were still walking around. And for those who don't know, about two-thirds of the book is devoted to Roulette Records, which was a front for the Genovese crime family in New York, and we couldn't talk about it. And, of course, we didn't know that when we signed. So that's the essence of the story. And some of these guys were still alive then, and we were very concerned about finishing the book. So in 06, the last of the Roulette regulars, as I call them, passed on, and we felt we could finish the story. So we did. And it took us about another 2.5 years, and as soon as we finished the book, Simon & Schuster grabbed it and put it out, and we were very amazed at that because they usually do, you know, presidential memoirs and stuff like that. So they took this book about rock and roll and really flew with it. And we changed the title to Me, the Mob, and the Music, and put it out, and it did so great for us. And as soon as we put out the book, we started getting calls for the music rights and the Broadway rights. After the movie, it's going to be, Barbara would like to produce it as a Broadway show.
Wow.
So the next couple of years are going to be real interesting. We're also doing a YouTube channel, by the way. They came to me, YouTube people, and asked if we would consider doing a Tommy James channel for YouTube. And yeah, it sounds great. We of course, a lot of our stuff is up there already, but YouTube has sort of become your label, your radio station, you know, for globally. And so we're going to have new videos up there every 2 weeks, and going to be us in the studio, us on the road, and of course making new music. We're going to actually release new records on the internet through YouTube.
When we continue with Tommy James, the story behind a song that spent 17 weeks on the charts and was one of his biggest hits of all time. This is Dave Lee on the record on WCCO. On the Record with Tommy James continues this afternoon on WCCO. And of course, it's a day filled with music, as tonight the Grammys are awarded. Dave Lee sitting in for a little while, and then Roshini will be here on WCCO. We continue now, though, with our conversation with Tommy James. Among his many hits was a song called I Think We're Alone Now. It was a top five song in 1967, but the song has some staying power. It was a number one hit 20 years later for Tiffany. And also charted in the top five in the UK as recently as 2006 for another group. What makes this song's musical journey so interesting is that a new acoustical version is on the way from the original artist, Tommy James.
The plan is, what we were going to do is, this. I recorded this brand new version of I Think We're Alone Now, which is slow and acoustic and totally opposite the original record. And I brought in the original Shondells, the three surviving members of the original Shondells, in to do the record with me. And we recorded it about 6 months ago. And it's going to be used as closing credits for the movie.
Hmm.
And the last scene in the movie is where Morris Levy, the head of the record company, dies. And I think we're alone now. You know, that was the idea of the song, that completely using exactly the same lyrics and completely changing the meaning of the song.
Yeah.
So we would like to release that, and I've been asked to, and I think we're going to do it in the spring. And we'll see how it goes. This is our third recording of I Think We're Alone Now, the original record, and then we did sort of an up-tempo version for the Night Big City album, and now this, and so it's sort of the record that wouldn't die, you know?
Well, I'm glad it didn't.
And Jimmy Wisner has been with me on all three records. Jimmy Wisner, who arranges and we produce records together. So there's a lot of history behind this and a big story behind it. And, of course, it's going to be in the movie, so that makes it relevant.
Let me ask you this, because I've read this before, and I wanted to hear it right from you. There was a time, I've read, that former Beatle George Harrison came to you and wanted you to record some of his songs. Is that true or false?
Well, it is. He was working with a group called Grapefruit. When they started Apple, Apple actually started out as a publishing company before it was a record label. And the idea was the Beatles were going to write songs for their friends and for other groups. And Money Money had just been the number one record for, I don't know, over a month over in Britain. And George wrote me about eight songs that were all sort of like Money Money. And he delivered them to my manager, and my manager got them to me, and I was just so blown away that he would do that. I couldn't believe it. I was just so flattered. But we ended up, by that time, we were into Crimson and Clover, and we had really changed our style, and we never really got back to the Money Money days, and so we never did any of these songs. And I always felt terrible, and I always wanted to apologize to him for not doing any of these songs, because they just weren't right for us at that moment. But I still have the tape, and I never got a chance to thank him. You know, he passed away, and I never really got a chance to connect with him.
Boy, how flattering, though.
It really is, yeah.
And there's other things that I got to ask you about, but one of those things, and I hope you don't tire of telling the story, but the song that kind of broke it for you has an interesting story behind it, Hanky Panky.
Sure. Well, Hanky Panky, I recorded with my high school cover band back in high school. It was 1963, and with the Shondells in my hometown, Niles, Michigan, in the WNIL radio studio. And actually, the morning man, Jack Douglas, was going to start a little label, a little regional label. And we had actually cut a record 2 years before that. And he said, "You guys still together and making records?" And he said, "Yeah." So he asked us to come in and record. So we recorded four songs for him. And one of them was Hanky Panky, this song that I had heard another group play, but I was just amazed at what it did to the audience that I saw. And so we sort of remembered all the words we could and went into the studio and recorded it.
My baby does the hanky panky.
And it came out locally in early 1964 in Niles and South Bend, Indiana, and right around that southern Michigan, northern Indiana region. And actually went number one, but we had no distribution, so it was local. So we kind of forgot about the record, and then I graduated from high school the following year in 65 and took my band on the road. And we're playing Chicago and up through Rush Street and up into Wisconsin, and I'm playing, it was early 1966, and I'm playing this dumpy little club in Janesville, Wisconsin, and right in the middle of my 2 weeks, the guy goes belly up. Shut down by the IRS. And we were lucky to make it out of there with our equipment. We go home with our tail between our legs feeling like real losers. And the minute I walk in the door, I get the call that changed my life. That's how the good Lord works, you know. Seriously, if that guy hadn't have gone bankrupt in the middle of my 2 weeks, you and I wouldn't be talking here today. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So anyway, I get the call from Pittsburgh that this record I had recorded, Hanky Panky, got played at some teen dance, and they got so many requests for it, they bootlegged it. And they just went from a disc to a disc and bootlegged it and sold 80,000 copies in 10 days, and we were sitting at number one.
Wow.
Only in America.
Yeah.
And I said, "You're kidding." And he said, "No." So you got to come to Pittsburgh. And so I went to Pittsburgh. I couldn't put the original group together. I went there by myself with the original record producer, Jack Douglas. And sure enough, I get there, and the record is number one, and I'm doing television and stuff, and I grabbed the first bar band I could find to be the Shondells, and this was really a miracle. And a week later, we went to New York to sell the master to a major label. So we get to New York, and we get a yes from Columbia, RCA, Atlantic. You remember Kama Sutra Records?
Oh, yeah. Yes, I do.
And we're just thrilled. I can't believe it. And the last place we took the record to was Roulette. And, you know, I went to bed that night feeling so great that we were probably going to go with Columbia or somebody, one of the big corporate labels. And so about 9 o'clock the next morning, the phone starts ringing. And it's all these other labels that had said yes the day before, calling me up and saying, "Listen, Tom, we got to pass." And I said, "What do you mean we got to pass? I thought we had a deal." And finally, Jerry Wexler at Atlantic tells us the truth, that Morris Levy, the head of Roulette Records, had called up all the other record companies and backed them off and said, "This is my record. Back off." And they did. And that's a true story. And that is, and of course, we then learned about Morris Levy a little bit, and he's a pretty notorious character, but we didn't realize what all he was into. So we ended up Going with Roulette, that's literally how we ended up going with Roulette. And I've often said, though, that if it wasn't for Morris Levy, there probably wouldn't have been a Tommy James. You know, it was, as little by little, we learned who we were involved with. You know, we'd meet somebody in Morris's office and shake hands with him, and he'd introduce us, and a week later we'd see him on the TV news being taken out of a warehouse in New Jersey in handcuffs, you know what I mean? So, isn't that the guy we just met in Morris's office? And it was, and this stuff kept happening, and finally we got the lowdown after we had signed the contract of who we were involved with. And so anyway, that's, I don't want to tell you the whole book, but I mean, that's in essence the story of Hanky Panky. And then, of course, they took Hanky Panky to number one. And that started our career. And, you know, we had 23 gold singles with Roulette and 9 platinum albums. We did over 100 million records with Roulette. So I guess you got to say we made the right decision. Getting paid was like taking a bone from a Doberman, but, you know, couldn't get paid, and it got very dangerous there several times. But that was our life with Roulette.
Wow. The name the Shondells in, how did you come up with that?
I actually made that up in study hall in high school. We were called the Tornadoes before that. And we just figured we needed a little more of a sophisticated name. So Tornadoes was pretty raw, you know. So you know, I was toying with names in study hall, and I just liked the way the word Shondells kind of rolled off my tongue. You know, I just liked the way it sounded. It was sort of effervescent, and it sounded musical, and so that became our name.
So now you know how they got the name the Shondells. But how did Tommy James come up with Crimson and Clover? That's next on The Record on WCCO. Welcome back to On the Record with Tommy James. On this afternoon before the Grammys are handed out tonight, we thought it would be fun to talk with an artist who has influenced a lot of musicians. One example for Tommy James would be his best-selling song, a number one song, Crimson and Clover. Not only was it huge at the time, but was again covered by other artists, including the Twin Cities' own music legend, Prince, and rocker Joan Jett. It also was featured in a lot of films like High Fidelity and multiple TV soundtracks. Did he have any idea, as he wrote it, the multi-generational influence it would have?
No. You know, this is quite a ways into the career by this time. We'd had a lot of hits by this time. I think it was Crimson Clover, I believe, was our 10th record. But it actually... were just two of my favorite words that I put together. Sounded very poetic, and we kind of wrote the song. We actually wrote 3 different versions of Crimson and Clover before we settled on the one that we recorded. And because it started out as a title before it was a song. And then I just started fooling with it, and, you know, it was 3 chords backwards. It was slow. It was a very different kind of record. But it was also so important to us, Crimson and Clover, because we wrote it actually out in the Humphrey campaign. And, you know, a weird thing happened. I don't want to get too long-winded with it, but when we left on the Humphrey campaign, in August, the big records of the day were all singles. It was us, the Rascals, Gary Puckett, Creedence Clearwater, the Association, the Buckinghams, all singles acts. When we got back 90 days later, it was all albums. It was Crosby, Stills, and Nash, Blood, Sweat, and Tears, Led Zeppelin, Neil Young, Joe Cocker. That first, you know, rush of albums. And in 90 days, the whole record industry turned upside down. And it was all albums. And so we realized that if we don't start selling albums at Roulette, our career is over. And Crimson and Clover was the first. We really burned our bridges with our producers, and we just kind of went in the studio and began doing everything ourselves, from album design to songwriting and producing. And we started that with Crimson and Clover. And fortunately, we were working on Crimson and Clover at that moment. And Crimson and Clover allowed us to make that jump from top 40 AM singles to FM progressive album rock and straddle the fence. And I don't think there's any other record that we ever wrote that would have done that for us in one shot like that.
Tommy James, tell us the story, if you would, about being invited to Woodstock back in the day.
Well, we were in Crystal Blue Persuasion was number one at that moment, and we were in Hawaii at the foot of Diamond Head. I mean, this is really incredible moment for us, because we were just, you know, the biggest decision of the day was whether to go swimming in the ocean or in the swimming pool. We're in a 21-room Spanish villa at the foot of Diamond Head, and we get a call. We're doing a show at the beginning and a show at the end of the 2 weeks. We're doing one show in Hilo and the next show in Honolulu, and we have almost 2 weeks to just be off and relax. And I get a call from my secretary, Joanne, at Roulette. You know, we're 6,000 miles away. And she says, listen, Ivy Kornfeld is upset. You know, he wants to know if you guys will come up and play this pig farm in upstate New York. you say there's going to be a lot of people. I said, what? A pig farm in upstate New York. You want me to leave paradise and fly 6,000 miles to play a pig farm? I said, you know what? You start without us, go ahead. You know what I mean? You know, if we're not there, start without us. So they did, and it was Woodstock. By the time we got to Woodstock. And we knew by Friday we had messed up really bad, because we watched the turnpike get shut down and everything. And so, we were kicking ourselves by the weekend. That's all I can tell you.
Well, your life was fascinating, because, I mean, I can't imagine what it was like for a young guy, you and the band, when you appeared on a thing like, I mean, the Ed Sullivan Show. It had to be overwhelming.
We have a big show for you tonight.
Well, it was. The first Sullivan Show we did, he really embarrassed us the week before. You know, we were, Crimson and Clover had just gone number one, and it was the week before we were supposed to be on. It was like February of 69. And we had just finished a tour with the Beach Boys across Canada. And we were in L.A. And it was the last day, it was down in L.A. And so we were supposed... I really picked their brain about the Ed Sullivan Show, because we knew we were going to do it the following week. And I was scared to death, because it was, first of all, it was live television. And Crimson and Clover, doing Crimson and Clover live, you knew it was going to be a train wreck, especially at the end with the fade. You know, they were never going to get it right.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm asking the Beach Boys, you know, they'd been on about a dozen times. And I, you know, so I, you know, tell me what you can. So they walked me through it. And so we're watching the Ed Sullivan Show the previous week. And, you know, all the guys are in the room, we're watching. He says, now next week, right here in our stage, Tony Jones and the Spandals will be here. Tony Jones and the Spandals, which means he can't read and he never heard of you. So we're just humiliated, and you know, I don't know what. So we finally made it back, and we you know, you rehearsed for a whole week before you did the Sullivan Show.
Sure.
And so he finally got my name right. You know, Engelbert Humperdinck, he has no problem with. James, he can't pronounce. So anyway, he finally got my name right, and we did the show, and it came off really nice. But the one thing I forgot about was that at the end of the show, if you're headlining the show, you got to talk to Ed. And, you know, he invited us to come over after the song, and, you know, you never know what's going to come out of his mouth. And so I walk up and he says, now, Tommy, I understand you were born and raised in New York City. Is that right? No! So I tell him, you know, Niles, Michigan. I was brought up, born in Dayton, Ohio. I told him where I went to school, blah, 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 blah. And he turns around and says, once again, born and raised in New York City, Tony Jones. Let's hear it for him. So I, that was my first Ed Sullivan show. And it was a moment to remember.
Ed Sullivan, the man who launched so many a musical career. Our final segment is On Deck with Tommy James, not only a recording star, but also a renowned producer. The story of one of his bigger hits as a producer is next when we finish up On the Record with Tommy James. This is Dave Lee on WCCO. Dave Lee here with Tommy James on the Record on WCCO this Sunday afternoon. Grassini will join you with a great lineup of guests for news and views in just a few minutes. But one more segment with Tommy. And we've discussed the range of Tommy James' career, from singing number one songs to writing them to being featured in countless movie and television soundtracks. But he was also a producer. In 1970, a band called Alive and Kickin' entered the charts with a million-selling record called Tighter, Tighter. The song was written and produced by Tommy James.
I had originally written it for myself. Now, by the way, this was in 1970, and the Shondells and I had kind of taken a six-month hiatus. You know, we were just going to kind of lay low for 6 months. We were exhausted. Well, I ended up going back in the studio and recording this song called Tighter, Tighter.
Oh, no, we're just a little bit tighter now, baby.
And I just didn't like the way it came out. I just didn't like the way I was singing it. So I had, this group had been after me to produce them, Alive and Kickin', and so I rewrote the song as a duet for a guy and a girl, which they were, and brought them into the studio with with the rest of their band, and the guitar player and the keyboard player played on top of the track that we had already done, and they sang it, and came out really nice, and we took it back to Roulette and put it out on Roulette, and it went number one. So that was my first outside production outside the Shondells.
The story is fascinating, and I would tell all of you who like Tommy James and the Shondells that Me, the Mob, and the Music would make a heck of a gift, I might add, Tommy.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
It's great stories, and you share them so well. So, again, I'm excited about the new direction here, and I'm excited to see when you get this thing up on the big screen and on Broadway.
Thank you very much.
Oh, absolutely, and I appreciate you being so generous with your time. I'm sure I could sit here for another hour and talk to you, but you've been very kind to take this amount of time.
My pleasure.
And great stories, great book, and we appreciate everything. Thank you so much.
It has been great talking with you. You take care now.
Yeah, and thanks for the music.
Thank you.
Look for the Tommy James movie later this year or early next year. Rashini is next with news and views. John Hines is in for me tomorrow, but I'll be back with you Thursday when we are live from the Mall of America for Let's Kick Hunger. I'm Dave Lee, and you've been listening to On the Record with Tommy James on WCCO.